Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, in a world rife with military conflict, the Iran nuclear deal is cited as an example of diplomacy at work. It seems clear that Donald Trump wants to destroy the deal, in part by misrepresenting it. How should reporters cover White House maneuvers to depict Iran's compliance as non-compliance and make clear what's at stake? We'll talk with The Intercept's Murtaza Hussein about that. Also on the show, if the animal agriculture industry has nothing to hide, why do they want to criminalize documentation of their practices? And if they have something to hide, why are state legislators helping them cover it up? We'll talk with Chip Gibbons, journalist and policy and legislative counsel for Defending Rights and Dissent, about their new report on ag gag laws. That's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at recent press. The Secretary General of the UN called Myanmar's persecution of the Rohingya ethnic cleansing, saying there's no better term to describe the now 380,000 people forced to flee a violent military campaign. This after decades of discrimination and repression in Myanmar, where Rohingya are denied citizenship and rights despite having been in the country for centuries. Rohingya militants killed 12 security personnel at a police post in late August. The government's response has been a brutal, scorched-earth campaign, burning villages and attacking civilians, while denying human rights organizations access to the region. Now, see if you would get a sense of that from PBS NewsHour's September 3rd account.
Overseas, Indonesia, the world's most populous Muslim nation, urged Myanmar today to stop its military crackdown against minority Muslims there, known as Rohingya. Myanmar officials say 400 people have been killed in recent clashes between soldiers and Rohingya insurgents, who claim Myanmar's 1.1 million Muslims are persecuted. The government considers the insurgents a terrorist group. The United Nations says about 73,000 Rohingya refugees have crossed the border into Bangladesh in the past 10 days.
So the lead is that a predominantly Muslim country is coming to the defense of other Muslims. There are clashes, a favored media term that suggests a symmetry of forces, and an implied balance between Rohingya's claim that they're persecuted and the government's assessment that insurgents are terrorists. But you might think that was early days. Surely the NewsHour will return to the story with a more humanistic take. Well, you'd be wrong about that. The September 5th program included a brief clip from a UN refugee agency official recounting hardships of those fleeing the country, which Judy Woodruff then followed up, you might say countered, with, quote, "Army officials in mostly Buddhist Myanmar say they are responding to attacks by Rohingya insurgents," close quote. Then, on September 13th, the show aired a brief clip of the UN chief calling on Myanmar authorities to end the violence, which Woodruff followed up with, quote, "Myanmar claims that it's only reacting to attacks by Rohingya insurgents," close quote. Human rights groups and the UN describe that reaction as ethnic cleansing. But the NewsHour seems to think that this horrific brutality is more of a potato-potato sort of thing. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Americans don't really need to be enjoined to never forget September 11th, 2001. But what about February 5th, 2003, when Colin Powell presented the UN Security Council with some blurry pictures and mistranslated intercepts he said proved that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction that the U.S. should go to war over? Today, media acknowledge that George W. Bush just wanted to invade Iraq and concocted a scenario that would make it seem justifiable. Donald Trump hasn't troubled to veil his hostile intentions toward Iran and his desire to undo the 2015 deal in which Iran agreed to give up enriched uranium, destroy thousands of centrifuges, and allow for UN inspections, among other things, in exchange for the lifting of economic sanctions. Some say it's a desire to please Saudi Arabia and Israel. Some say it's just a desire to destroy whatever Barack Obama did. But whatever the cause is, undoing the deal could have major negative consequence, and not just in Iran. Here to talk about the situation is Murtaza Hussain, a journalist for The Intercept. He joins us by phone from here in town. Welcome back to Counterspin, Murtaza Hussain.
Thank you for having me.
Well, the telegraphing began even before Nikki Haley, U.S. ambassador to the U.N., gave her recent speech at the American Enterprise Institute. Donald Trump, who has to recertify Iran's compliance with the deal every 90 days, about a month ago simply said, "I think they'll be noncompliant." Coming from someone else, that might mean, "I don't think they're actually complying." But from Trump, it sounds more like, "I'm going to say they're noncompliant." What, first of all, do we know about the reality of Iran's fulfilling its end of the 2015 deal?
The IAEA and European Union and Russia, China, have all indicated that they believe Iran still be compliant with terms of the original nuclear agreement. And the Trump administration has not really provided any evidence in contravention of that. The American objection to the deal now seems to be framed around issues which never had anything to do with the deal, the general history of distrust and animosity that existed between Iran and the United States. And they're using this as a means of reframing the deal retroactively about non-nuclear issues as a way of ultimately terminating it.
Well, we got that feeling from Nikki Haley's speech, which was really quite something. What were some of the things that she said in that speech that tell us the hand that the state is trying to deal here?
Well, in Nikki Haley's speech, she identified a long list of American grievances after terrorism over the past two decades, which had been sponsored by Iranian military in Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, and elsewhere. But the thing is, both Iran and the United States have a long history of grievances with each other, stretch back several decades. Arms control agreements, and we have a long history of these during the Cold War, they are seldom ever created to address political issues, issues between states extraneous to the strictly defined goal of controlling the proliferation of weapons. So when the nuclear deal was created, it was created very narrowly around the nuclear issues itself, specifically because if they made it about all these other issues, it would be impossible to ever reach any agreement. Now, in the attempt to retroactively reframe the deal, it seems very clear that the attempt to torpedo it after the fact by saying, well, no, it's actually, we have all these other problems with Iran that we want to deal with, and the deal must be restructured to accommodate that. But it's simply impossible. There's no way that it's going to be able to reopen the deal. And the Iranians themselves have indicated that any attempt to do so would be a non-starter.
Well, it certainly seems like moving the goalposts to say we're going to say they're non-compliant for things that are not actually in the agreement itself, you know. But nevertheless, the Los Angeles Times called Nikki Haley's speech an elegant but unconvincing attack on the deal, which I found kind of surprising, especially given that one of the things she said was, judging any international agreement begins and ends with the nature of the government that signed it. Does it respect international law? Can it be trusted to abide by its commitments? I mean, that just sounds like a howler to me. But there was this idea to say Iran is just inherently lawbreaking.
Yeah, it was a very strange speech in some ways. And the idea that the entire problem is making deal with Iran at all, then the only option other than that is to have a war or to ratchet up tensions to the point where war becomes surely possible. It seems very clear that they are trying to sabotage the deal, but because the deal itself was negotiated not just by the United States, but several other parties around the world, the so-called P5+1 negotiating parties, they're all loath to reopen this issue. As far as they're concerned, they're happy with the deal. It's opened Iran up to their own businesses to potentially do business, very lucrative, untapped markets. And for the Americans to very transparently try to undermine that deal that took a lot of effort to negotiate, it won't be looked upon kindly by other countries. And especially under this administration, a very bellicose and, you could say, unprofessional administration, for them to try to paint this anything other than what it is, which is an attempt to cancel the deal, it's not going to have a lot of traction.
This certifying process, this thing about the president certifying compliance every 90 days, that wasn't in the deal itself. That was something Congress imposed. So I understand that declaring Iran noncompliant kicks things back to Congress. What would that mean?
This 90-day period was something which was imposed by Congress so they could have very stringent oversight of the deal going forward. Now, Trump decides to decertify, it'll be Congress's decision what it wants to do next. They could try to reimpose nuclear sanctions. They could impose new non-nuclear sanctions. But the thing is, Congress has been historically hawkish on the Iran nuclear issue, probably even more than the executive. And it seems extremely likely that they'll try to impose new sanctions. And if they do impose new sanctions, Iran will also respond in some way, and which you could very quickly see in dynamic created, which just leads to the unraveling of the deal as a whole.
Well, finally, elite media generally support the Iran deal, even if they sometimes still refer falsely to Iran's nuclear weapons program, which they've never been shown to have. Nima Shirazi noted that the Washington Post just last month had to run a correction on that. But there's editorial support for this deal, and it seems like reporters see the goalposts being moved, but they're just sort of narrating it. The New York Times on August 31st led with, "The world's nuclear inspectors complicated President Trump's effort to find Iran in violation by declaring that the inspections found no evidence that the country is breaching the agreement." I find it a weird way to cover it. They said the reports from the IAEA that Iran is complying make it harder to create an argument that Iran is in violation. I don't really understand that way of reporting it, but I wonder what in general you would like to see from the press more or less of when it comes to reporting on Iran and this deal.
Well, I think I had read something in the New York Times, an editorial a few months back, cautioning his efforts to tank the deal. They're speaking diplomatic language, which is the phraseology you identified, sort of an example of passive narration of what's going on here. I think that as the efforts by the administration to tank the deal intensify, which seems very clear that they will, there should not be any equivocating what's going on here and the risk of what's happening here. And the fact that this is being done for completely spurious reasons. The United States has an interest in stopping nuclear proliferation. This deal stops proliferation, even if Iran didn't have a nuclear program before. It precludes them from choosing to have one in the future through the stringent monitoring. So why is this deal being destroyed? It's being destroyed because of the interests of donors or pressure groups who are ideologically invested in a conflict between Iran and the United States, and they don't care about non-proliferation. They're willing to sacrifice non-proliferation, the core U.S. national security interests, in the service of their ideological crusade against Iran, which has been going on for quite some time. And not to say that Iran is blameless in the situation, but at this present juncture, the Iranians negotiated a deal in good faith, which they seem to be adhering to, and the United States, which is trying to renege on it. I think that the press should talk about the very real risks of war and the completely irrational nature of what's happening right now, but they should also talk about why this is happening, what interest is being served by destroying a very critical U.S. diplomatic achievement, and if they do succeed in tanking the nuclear deal, how is America going to be able to do diplomacy in the future? The world may reasonably conclude that the U.S. is no longer capable of doing diplomacy as it has been since the era of the Cold War.
We've been speaking with Murtaza Hussein from The Intercept. You can find his recent piece, "How Donald Trump is Trying to Blow Up the Iran Nuclear Deal," on TheIntercept.com. Murtaza Hussein, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
Simply put, if an industry goes after people who seek to investigate it, it's a pretty good indication that they're doing something they don't want you to know. This is certainly the case with the animal agriculture industry. The term ag gag, introduced by New York Times food writer Mark Bittman, describes the slew of laws introduced to target undercover investigations and whistleblowing about the industry. Because, it turns out, when people don't just hear about, but see, piglets having their heads bashed against cement floors or cows too sick to walk being picked up by forklifts, it affects how they feel and how they act. The battle between those defending the industry's ability to shroud its practices in darkness and those fighting for our right to see and then make choices based on that knowledge is ongoing. And, for the most part, and for now, sunshine is winning. A new report tells the history of that fight. Ag gag across America, corporate-backed attacks on activists and whistleblowers, comes from Defending Rights and Dissent and the Center for Constitutional Rights. We're joined now by the report's primary author. Chip Gibbons is policy and legislative counsel for Defending Rights and Dissent and a journalist. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Chip Gibbons.
Thank you for having me. I'm a big fan of all the work that FAIR has done over the years.
Well, thank you. And let's start then with a definition. We're talking about a number of different, mostly state laws. So what defines them as ag gag?
Ag gag laws are any laws that try to prevent the public from knowing what goes on in the animal agriculture industry. They all target documentation and undercover investigations and whistleblowing, but the ways in which they do it vary state by state. But the main practices are prohibiting documentation of agricultural practices, and this is something like passing a law saying you can't take photo or video inside of an agriculture facility. The other big way they do this is by prohibiting misrepresentations in job applications. So if I'm an undercover investigator and I'm applying for a job at a factory farm and the hirer asks me, are you affiliated with PETA? I'm obviously not going to say yes, or I'm not going to get the job. So the investigator would not be entirely truthful about their background there. And a number of states have made that a crime. And the third way, and this is actually kind of counterintuitive to a lot of folks, is they impose mandatory reporting requirements for reporting animal cruelty. And a lot of people might say, well, that sounds like that's helping animals. Isn't this what you want? Aren't there similar laws for child abuse? And the problem with that is that if an undercover investigator reports animal cruelty, he or she or they blow their cover as an investigator. And these reports, what's so damning about them is that they don't usually take like one or two isolated instances of somebody abusing an animal. They document systemic practices, systemic abuse. So you can't do a long-term investigation that way. And it allows the agricultural industry then turn around and say, oh, this is an isolated incident. We don't allow people to smash piglets' heads on floors, which is the legal and established way of euthanizing piglets.
Well, the industry didn't just decide one day to create these laws. They were clearly a response, and they were a response to activists doing just the kind of work that you're describing, right?
Yeah, that's the really interesting thing about studying these laws in depth. There's two waves. There's a series of bills between 90 and 91 that don't get a lot of attention that are passed in Kansas, Montana, and North Dakota. And they're very much your classic ag gag bill, no taking photo or video inside an agriculture facility. But the bills really start to heat up starting in 2011. And when we went back and we studied each of the different current ag gag bills that have been passed, we found a very interesting pattern, which was that in many cases, these are direct responses to investigations. So you would see PETA or another environmental or animal rights group going into a facility, and they would expose animal cruelty. And in a lot of cases, these resulted in unprecedented prosecutions. People were arrested, changes were made, and these legislators, instead of celebrating that the laws are finally being enforced when they never had been before, turn around and say, oh, this is quite bad. Let's criminalize the practices that led to this wrongdoing being exposed. And it's really shocking to think about that undercover investigators would uncover wrongdoing, in some cases, actual criminal conduct. You would have investigations by authorities, prosecutions, arrests, laws actually being able to be enforced for the first time, and the legislator turns around and says, we're going to make exposing that conduct illegal.
It is shocking.
It's shocking.
It's counterintuitive, one would hope. But there's been resistance from the start. I mean, these laws don't really hold legal water, do they? They're maybe unconstitutional.
Both the laws in Idaho and Utah have been found by district courts to be unconstitutional for violating the First Amendment and in some cases for violating the 14th Amendment. So when you ban photography inside a factory farm, you run up against the First Amendment for a number of reasons. First of all, for a law to be constitutional, it has to be viewpoint neutral. And what these laws do is they only penalize videos that are critical of agriculture or critical of the factory farms. If you took a video showing wonderful happy cows and how much they loved living in a dairy factory, you're not going to go to jail under these laws. The other thing is that laws are supposed to be content neutral, and these laws specifically ban communications about the agriculture industry. They also, in a number of cases, the harm done happens when they're reported by the press, not the filming itself. So it burdens the free press. In Wyoming, there was actually an issue with the First Amendment's freedom to petition the government clause because the initial version of the law only banned collecting data if your intent was to submit it to a state or federal agency, which is once again unthinkable because it makes sense that a federal agency would want evidence of E. coli in the stream polluting everyone's drinking water. But the state legislature of Wyoming decided that if you do that, they want you in jail.
You mentioned there being repercussions. I just want to make as a note, the report does note that when abuse does come to light, it tends to be, or it is, the low-level workers who are fired, as though, you know, the minimum wage guy came up with the idea of, you know, caging pigs in this way or something like that.
Yeah, I don't think it'll be much of a surprise to your listeners that we have a very unequal justice system. And I think one of the things that's been most frustrating to the groups that put on these undercover investigators is it's never the big corporate shots that go to jail. It's never the corporate CEOs. It's always somebody at the bottom of the ladder who is overworked, underpaid, abused themselves, under a lot of stress. So it is important to not be overly celebratory about these types of prosecutions. I only highlight that they occurred because, I mean, they're extremely rare to begin with at any level to have animal cruelty prosecutions on a Midwestern farm. It was, I believe, the first one was a result of an undercover video.
Right. Well, the introduction of the term terrorism is important, you know, and the use of that term or eco-terrorism or whatever variant, it implies violence and it kind of shuts people's brains off, I think, or that's the hope. You know, I know that you've written about the power of crying terrorism in other contexts, but what is it meant in the ag-gag fight?
So Will Potter from Green is New Red has documented this in really great detail. As the environmental movement and the animal rights movement gained popularity, there was a state backlash where they started conflating activism with terrorism. And once you do that, you get to open the floodgates for all kinds of legislative repression. In the early 90s, late 80s, Congress considers for the first time a law, it's not an ag gag law, but it would create federal penalties for crimes against animal enterprises. And the FBI of George H.W. Bush actually comes and testifies against the law, saying, we don't want this law. There's already enough laws on the books. There's state laws that cover this. And then industry groups started promoting this narrative that there were animal terrorists, eco-terrorists. And then we had a problem. Like, there's a problem. We need a remedy. And the remedy has been to put together all of these laws like the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. And, you know, once you put the laws on the book, that then reinforces the narrative that there's a problem. You know, if you said, we want laws to silence our opponents because people are aware of the environmental impact of our industry, or they're aware of ethical issues with using animals for commercial purposes, and they don't like our products anymore, you know, no one would say that was okay. But if you say, oh, we have a terrorism problem, we need anti-terrorism legislation, that's a completely different story for the public. And Will Potter got some internal documents years ago about the coalition that lobbied for the Federal Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, and they put an enormous amount of significance on using the word terrorism because they realized when you demonize your opponents as terrorists, you then get to use the harsh legislation. If you just call them activists or critics, it's not going to go over very well. And interestingly enough, the model AGAG bill, which is promoted by ALEC, uses terrorism in the name. And if you're convicted of filming inside a factory farm under the ALEC bill, you then have to register in a state. I mean, this part of the bill was never passed anywhere, but it's worth looking at their thinking. You'd have to register with the Attorney General as part of the state animal and ecological terrorist database. So, I mean, that's what the other side is thinking. They're thinking if we label these people terrorists, then we can make them register, we can shut them down, we can do all that stuff.
Well, finally, of course, it's important on its own, but it almost doesn't need saying that this idea of corporations or companies criminalizing the documentation of these processes, it has meaning and it has impact beyond agriculture.
Yeah. So other industries look at ag-gag laws and say, why not us? I mean, you know, activists look at ag-gag laws and say, why are you singling out only the agricultural industry for protection? That's kind of instructive of what your real intent is. But other industries have the same thought, and they say, why can't we be protected too? So you've seen ag-gag laws gradually expand into general gag laws. Mm-hmm. And the first instance of this is in Wyoming, which doesn't criminalize filming inside a farm, but taking samples from rivers, doing what's called data trespass. So there's a lot of cattle ranchers. Obviously, cattle ranching is not good for the environment. People take resource data from the rivers to document E. coli, other bacteria in there. And that was the first expansion of it. But then after that, you saw in North Carolina, they created a bill that imposed civil, not criminal penalties like previous ones did, on whistleblowers in every single industry. And then Arkansas did the same thing as well. So you now have these gag bills that can be used not just in the agricultural industry, but if someone exposes abuse in a nursing home, in a retirement home, or anywhere else, it gives their employer the right to sue them. So they've basically taken the ag out of ag gag.
We've been speaking with journalist Chip Gibbons, Policy and Legislative Counsel for Defending Rights and Dissent, and contributor to the book The Henry Kissinger Files, forthcoming from Verso. The report Ag Gag Across America is available on rightsanddissent.org. Chip Gibbons, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.